This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is September 16th, 2021, and this is episode 257.
I'm Scott Lonebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're back to the greatest BC premier bracket. We left it out of last week's live show. Thank you to everyone who made it to watch us on YouTube or listen to us after. And after we discuss those results in the next round, we're going to get into the final days of the 44th federal election and give some predictions. At least I want to make some bold ones because, I don't know, I've been staring at too many polls and just trying to figure out what's going to go on. Thanks as well to everyone who contributes to the show every month or annually, gives us money in some ways. It keeps us going. It encourages us. It gets you access to the Slack discussions, which have been fun, busy, distracting, all in a good way. Join them, join us at patreon.com/politicoast. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. So let's get back to the greatest BC premier bracket. As we've been discussing for a month and a half now, we're trying to find the greatest premier in BC history. Really, I just needed an excuse to figure out who all the old white men were who were in the nonpartisan era and what did they actually do. We're now into the Liberal era, the original Liberals from kind of 1900 to 1950. The previous discussion 2 weeks ago, we paired up Harlan Carey Brewster, the first Liberal, and John Oliver, not the British comedian, but I think this was a different Englishman who'd come over and led our province. Oliver did quite a bit. I think Brewster was the one who actually brought in the right to vote for women. Oliver won it 16 to 12. At one point, they were tied, and so I was a little worried about what we'd have to do. Maybe we'd just, I don't know.
Sudden death?
I'd give you the tie-breaking vote, maybe, because I think I actually do vote. So John Oliver, better premier than Harlan Brewster.
Or at least one with better name recognition.
Yeah. Next, we're going to jump ahead a couple premiers. We're going to skip over two Liberals who we'll come back to because I think it's a slightly easier contest. But this week, I want to talk about the Coalition Liberals. These are two premiers from the 40s and early 50s who led coalition governments. BC actually used to have coalition governments because we didn't want the socialists to win. So John Hart.
Nowadays, we just try and put those coalitions in one party.
Yeah.
And
this kind of led to that. This is a really interesting period of BC's history. So John Hart is the 23rd premier of BC. He led from December 9th, 1941 to December 29th, 1947, 6 years. He took over following the 1940 election. That's when Patello, who we'll talk about probably on next week's podcast, lost the Liberal majority, winning only 21 seats. The CCF actually won the popular vote in that election, but they only got 14 seats. And so there's this tension as the Conservatives also had 12 seats. And there was this Labour candidate, Tom Uphill, who was basically a socialist, but didn't want to caucus with the CCF because he was a weird person. And we should get back to him one day because he's a fascinating part of BC history and actually quite influential. So we had a very divided parliament in 1941. Patello didn't want to join with the Conservatives or work with them. So the Liberals deposed him and appointed John Hart as the new premier because he was happy to form a grand coalition to keep the socialists out. Hart would go on to run the 1945 election as a coalition between the Conservatives and Liberals, and together they won 37 of 48 seats. The CCF actually grew their vote, but they lost 4 seats because of the fun of first past the post. During his time as premier, John Hart did a lot. He undertook the rural electrification program of the province in 1945. The first half of his premiership, I should point out, was during World War II, so he had to manage the province during the war effort. He also began the construction of Highway 97 from Prince George to Dawson Creek, a section of highway that's now named after him, the John Hart Highway. and he relaunched the first major hydroelectric development in BC, the Bridge River Power Project, which was established between Lewitt and Whistler. The BC Power Commission he created at that time would go on to become BC Hydro, one of the first big crown corporations. He retired in 1947 and became the speaker for the remainder of that parliament, and he is noted in Wikipedia as one of the few premiers in this province to leave office under neither a cloud of defeat or scandal.
Just a great province we've got here with our politics.
That was true then for every premier before him. I think it's true for every premier after him, just about. We're not nice to our premiers.
Yeah.
But many are quite corrupt on the way out, though, to be fair. The other premier we're going to look at is Boss Johnson. He was born as Bjorn Ingimar Johnson, an Icelandic name, which was Bjossi, which he got anglicized to be Boss. He was also known as Byron.
Yeah. Bjossi is the diminutive, like the nickname for Bjorn.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And
people called him Boss, not because he was the boss, but because...
Oh, he was the boss.
He ended up being the boss, though. He was very prominently a lacrosse player, Wikipedia tells us. It spends as much time, as you pointed out, regaling his lacrosse achievements as a goaltender as it did his political achievements, though I think his political achievements were quite substantial.
Yeah. He played 3 seasons of professional lacrosse in Vancouver, which, you know, not nothing, but doesn't really seem to be on the same level as running a province.
Yeah, he was the 24th premier, taking over right after Hart retired in December of 1947, and he would go on to lead until August 1st, 1952. He introduced compulsory health insurance in the province and a 3% sales tax to pay for it. Both of those things we thankfully still have, although both are broadly more expensive now, for better or worse. He continued to expand highways, the railways, and Wikipedia tells me he also built the first hydroelectric dam in BC, which was the Kenny Dam. I don't know which was first and which was what the difference.
Well, I think we can safely assume Hart's dam was first, just because he was the premier before.
It might just be that he started that one, but it wasn't finished, but the Kenny Dam finished first. Maybe that's the nuance here. Anyway, they loved building dams in this period, and the premier that follows Boss Johnson also built a lot of dams, and we'll get to him. Johnson,
for half a century, that's just what you did when you became premier. You got a dam built.
It was much easier then. We didn't take into account the local indigenous rights and title and or environmental impacts often. Johnson appointed Nancy Hodges as the second female speaker in the entire Commonwealth. The first, notably, was Mary Ellen Smith, who was also appointed by a Liberal government in British Columbia. So we got to take those two titles. He disbanded the BC Provincial Police in favor of the RCMP, a decision that the city of Surrey is regretting now. I think we talked about this on our episode about the police last summer. It was an interesting period that we had our own police force.
Yeah, we did mention about that.
Johnson also passed a bill to give Chinese, Asian, British Columbians, as well as Indigenous peoples the vote. I think BC was one of the first jurisdictions in Canada to grant votes to Indigenous people, other than the time John A. Macdonald tried to do it, which is a weird incident in history. Johnson did a coalition as well with the Conservatives in 1949, and together their parties won 61% of the vote and 39 seats, which was the largest victory in British Columbia history, bigger than even the 2001 victory, one of the very few real majorities. The CCF at that time still got 35% of the vote, but was reduced to just 7 seats. And of course, Uphill held his.
Biggest victory in terms of popular vote, in terms of the just complete domination of the electoral map and the seats, 2001's bigger.
Good point.
Because there were 2 left over that weren't just swept by the Liberals.
After that, though, in the final act of his government in 1952, together the Liberals and Conservatives passed the Provincial Elections Amendment Act to bring in the alternative vote. They called it the single transferable vote at the time, but electoral reform nerds will tell you it's not actually STV because it uses a majoritarian counting method. Anyway, the point was they wanted to change the voting system so the CCF would never win. That historically backfired massively because people were fed up with the Liberals and the Conservatives at this point. And ultimately, the SoCreds ended up winning in 51 and 52 enough to... Ultimately, the SoCreds ended up winning in 1952, and the coalition was reduced to just 10 seats. It was a minority parliament, and we'll get into that when we start talking about Wacky Bennett. But you can thank Boss Johnson for destroying the Liberal and Conservative brands in BC for half a century. Actually, the Conservatives have never recovered, but he was the last Liberal premier until 2001. And yeah, those are our two premiers. John Hart, the man who led us through the war, and Boss Johnson, the guy who destroyed his party, but also expanded the franchise. So go cast your vote. Politicos.ca/bracket. We'll have a Twitter poll up there and on our Twitter account very shortly. Interesting people. Let's get into the main segment, though. We're not here to talk about the past. We're here to talk about the future. Actually, we're going to talk about the past week of the election. The final countdown is on until Election Day on Monday. Last week, we had the debate. We talked about it live on the podcast right after it had happened. Let's start there, Scott. One of the things we talk about, or people talk about a lot, is it's hard to tell who wins or loses a debate in the immediate aftermath. It's the narratives that develop out of it. Did any narratives actually develop out of this debate?
So there were two. One of them was that the debate format sucks and the debate commission is bad and should feel bad. The second one is that...
I'll just note, I think we said that last week.
Yeah, we did say that last week. In fact, my Twitter feed was filled up with that during the debate. Like that was very much an early sentiment that got locked in and dominated a lot of the discussions that followed. The other big one is that apparently all it takes for the Bloc to undergo a resurgence is one question in a debate. Not the answers that anyone asked, or that anyone gave, but just the question itself.
Yeah, so this is the focus that's now come out on, should Shachi Cole have called Bill 21 discriminatory and doubled down on it, as now Justin Trudeau, Aaron O'Toole, and Jagmeet Singh have all called for her and or the debate commission to apologize to Quebec, to Yves-François Blanchet, for that question, which I think is dumb.
Yeah, it's not a great look, particularly for Trudeau and Singh on this one. It puts them in a really weird position of basically having the view that Canada is a fundamentally racist country except for Quebec. It is utterly incoherent, that and their past statement.
Yeah, they have criticized the bill in the past. They have said we should challenge it. The federal government is considering intervening in court challenges around it. Jagmeet Singh has said that it's a priority to, or not necessarily a priority to fight it. He is a person who would be directly affected by such a bill as someone who wears a religious symbol in his turban. I get the like politics that Quebecers are mad, or at least the premier of Quebec, and that this bill is still largely popular, but it's not universally popular, especially among the people the NDP are probably trying to court. Although I guess they're trying to get some Bloc switchers.
Yeah.
Partisanship makes people dumb.
Just a different place. And their view of secularism is obviously quite a bit different than the Anglo view of it. But as a result, you could conceivably have a lot of people who, on every other metric, would look a lot like your pretty typical progressives, but not on this particular issue. So it's entirely possible there's a chunk of NDP accessible voters who are very much with Legault on this one.
As far as I can tell, Annamie Paul has not asked for an apology. I don't actually think Maxime Bernier has asked for an apology over it, but he wasn't allowed at the debate anyway.
Although, if Annamie Paul had asked for an apology, would anyone have noticed?
I don't have anything to rebut that with.
She just does not, like, apparently there is a campaign going on. She got invited to debates, but has been basically completely absent from the election.
So I want to touch on this other element from the debates is I did see a lot of people liking her performance. And I think I was critical of her last week on the pod or in some of my, you know, discussions with people after. But
I didn't particularly find her debate performance that great either.
I did see a lot of credit given to her from various sides, from people who watched it and saw something different than me. Someone sent me a video as well of one point where it was a three-way debate, and I think it was Trudeau and O'Toole arguing over climate or something, and she was just standing there silently. But someone had overlaid the Curb Your Enthusiasm music to just drive home her like exasperation at these two guys arguing the world burns. And as you listen and watch that roll out, you can see just in her eyes how tiring it is listening to them. And you can see some compassion for her. I'll say that maybe I misjudged. I think the debate did do some good for Annamie Paul and the Greens. I don't think it did enough to move the votes or win her Toronto Centre. It at least didn't hurt. So that's the campaign we've had, is everyone has gotten stuck.
Pretty much. Although the Liberals seem to have managed to pull out a couple points compared to where they were going into the debate, which also does that, what was the post-debate narrative? Because that surprised me. I did not find Trudeau's debate performance to be very inspiring or just good at all. He reminded me very much of kind of the angry, quippy Andrew Scheer performance from last time. And I honestly had a loss on what people saw in that.
I don't think it was the debate. I think he has realized that his real opponent isn't Erin O'Toole, but it's the dumb protesters and the People's Party of Canada. And every time, and even in the last 24, 48 hours, it's Jason Kenney and Doug Ford. These are the people that if he had been running against the entire time, he wouldn't have to say the words Erin O'Toole. He could just say, this is the conservative movement in Canada, justly or not. And that gets people afraid because no one likes those assholes. 10% of Canadians like those assholes. And so you saw after the gravel was thrown at him incident and this other incident here in Vancouver where slurs were yelled at his wife and he responded, don't you have a hospital to go protest at? Which I thought was a dumb comment, but
it's a bad comment.
Yeah, it was bad. You should be the target.
Not only that, particularly just the day after he made an announcement about a renewed Liberal government would make it a criminal offense to block health buildings or healthcare buildings and threaten workers. Like, it's just completely cuts across that. And only that, it's just bad leadership to try and take the criticism justly or unjustly leveled at him and try and direct them to the healthcare workers who have no part in this.
Oh, I agree with that. But I think what potentially has helped him is Canadians saw the frustration and agreed with it and see him under attack as not necessarily a rally to the leader, but it's if they're against him, I don't want to be with the people who are against him. Kind of an enemy of my enemy, weirdly, kind of situation. Neglecting the fact there are more than just the Liberals and the PPC on the ballot. And it's not a theory that requires a massive amount of people to move their votes based on that, but we have arguably seen the Liberals pick up just enough where they're back from being neck and neck with the Conservatives to having a slight air between them.
Yeah, they're now, I think, fairly definitively back in the front runner position.
And if you couple that with some more stumbles, let's say, some more flip-flops on the Conservative campaign, they've kind of lost their argument for being ready for prime time, as it were.
Yeah, they had a really good first couple weeks of the campaign. They basically, I think, set the agenda for at least the first 2 weeks of the election. They never really seem to have found a follow-on or a second act to that, and it's really, I think, held them back. And then getting caught up in the gun debate and everything else on that seems to have stalled out the Conservatives.
And they've had a couple other things that they've been pushed on this past week. Like, they were pushed on the carbon tax, and O'Toole conceded that he wouldn't necessarily immediately repeal the Trudeau carbon tax, and he'd instead work province by province on reducing their emissions, and obfuscated a bit more about what he would actually do, which probably upset the true blue conservatives, who want to see him repeal a carbon tax and fine, maybe do whatever he's planning. And then the more moderate liberal types who are like concerned to want to see him do stuff on climate. And he's trying to balance a lot of competing pressures, and it's not coming off well.
No, it looks uncertain, insincere, whatever other word you want to throw at it. But yeah, between this and the change in position on guns and a few other things, just makes it look like the campaign doesn't really have any coherent message or direction to it. Which, like, maybe you can get away with one of those changing a position on, but if you do it multiple times during a campaign, it's just shreds credibility, and I think that's where they're stumbling with. And they didn't really have something to respond to that with, and I don't know, they should have tried to find something to reset the message, redirect, I don't know, the Liberals or something, rather than trying to do this, we kind of still have a carbon tax, but not really thing they settled on. And I generally like the idea of keeping the system in place rather than going to that weird personal loyalty savings card account thing. But it did no one any favor, or did him no favors, to muck around with it, even if I think it is a slightly better policy he's landed on now.
And then I think the thing we'll still have to see how it exactly shakes out, but it's so late in the game and it's just evolving in the last 24 hours, is Alberta finally moving to deal with the overfull ICUs they have from COVID-19. They're dealing with, I don't even have today's numbers, but like triple the cases BC has right now. I saw 1,500 one day this week, and talking about moving people from ICUs in Alberta to other provinces, which is wild and means more and more people are going to die. And so Alberta has finally implemented sort of a vaccine passport thing, but businesses can opt out. And if they opt out, they're subject to more restrictions, and it's weird. And everyone thinks it's dumb and too little too late. And Kenny also apologized for mistakes, but then also said he does not apologize for the open for summer system. And now the Trudeau Liberals have jumped on this, saying that is what you'll get in terms of leadership if you elect Erin O'Toole. Basically, my question is this going to give Trudeau a majority?
Like, on one hand, it feels a little incoherent to say, under a different government, not the government that I've been running for the past 6 years and throughout all of COVID, this would have happened. Like, it just doesn't make sense, because Trudeau's the prime minister. If this really mattered on that front, why did this happen? On the other hand, yeah, it's like a weakness of the Conservatives generally. I don't think there's been a Conservative government that's generally done all that. Manitoba's doing okay for a while, I think, but early on. But other than that, yeah, there hasn't been a real kind of well-run Conservative response in this country to it. So, absolutely a weakness that the Liberals can hammer on.
I could say the François Legault response has been strong, although he doesn't affiliate with the federal Conservatives, but he has sort of endorsed them, yeah.
It's like Conservative for Quebec,
yeah,
in the Quebec provincial context.
But now, yeah, O'Toole's facing this challenge because there's also this kind of suspicion, conspiracy theory borderline, that Kenny was also holding off any reaction or any new restrictions until after the election so he could help the federal government, because he didn't want to look bad.
You mean help
bad.
The federal Tories?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's pretty likely that if the fats on the ground hadn't forced the Alberta government's hand, this would have been a Tuesday of next week announcement.
And it's gross. And people are dying. And like, when I look at the campaign Erin O'Toole has run and the kind of policies he's pulled together, I would not put him in the same realm as a Jason Kenney government or even a Doug Ford government. He even seems like he'd be better than Brian Pallister, since he'd be in the country most of the time, I assume. But he's got
O'Toole is very clearly a different type of conservative than those two, for sure. He hasn't necessarily done a great job of conveying that, and I think a lot of it is there's just a lot of baggage with the Federal Conservative Party that takes more than 4 weeks to shake off, and if anything, I think that's been the problem with their campaign. One of the two problems. One was not having a follow-up to the really good first 2 weeks, and the three problems. The flip-flopping on guns and climate. But the other one is not doing the work ahead of time to actually build the kind of change in direction of the party and get that narrative going well ahead of the campaign. And it's weird, though, because you saw hints of it. What was it? Labor Day 2020, O'Toole did that video that I think got a lot of people to perk up and pay attention, talking about a more blue-collar friendly, union-friendly conservatism. There was putting out a climate plan early that, other than the weird carbon savings account, was pretty decent. But those are like two things in a year since he became leader. And just was none of the other connecting tissue between those and the campaign he ran. And it made it feel, I don't necessarily want to say hollow, but there wasn't enough kind of weight behind it when he did unveil the much more kind of targeted in the center of the spectrum campaign and platform, which is a little too bad, because this is absolutely what the conservatives should be doing. This is the first campaign that the party's ran in a decade that I haven't hated, and in large part because of how they've positioned themselves. But the actual execution has left some stuff to be desired.
So I want to park a discussion on the aftermath and where this might lead for the conservatives until after the predictions, because that's predictive. Let's maybe pivot and talk about the NDP's past week, which has been, like all of their weeks, like neither particularly stunning, but also not awful. Like,
this has been a very unsubstantive week. Like, we've gotten into the stupid season of the campaign, where it's all like the poking at every little weakness the other party has, every bad candidate thingy and whatnot, rather than any sort of putting forward a vision of where they want to take the country.
Maybe that's inevitable when they all release their platforms relatively early, that we've already discussed all the policy. We haven't, obviously, but we didn't pull out any policy to discuss this week. And so instead, what we have is a headline story about two federal NDP candidates resigning after anti-Semitic social media posts were dug up. One who a couple years ago tweeted at Oprah asking if she thought Auschwitz was real. That's pretty damn anti-Semitic. And the other who just last year was, that first one, his excuse was he was a teenager at the time. I think he was 16 and now he's 18 or 19. So
I think the teenager at the time can be understandable if it was 20 years ago, but if it's 2 years ago, that doesn't really fly.
And also, don't make weird jokes about Auschwitz.
Like, also that.
16-year-olds should know that. The other one was tweeting or retweeted a conspiracy theory that Israel was hiding COVID vaccines. Not good. Usually when NDP candidates get accused of anti-Semitism, it's the, oh, they signed on to remarks critical of Israel, as the Vancouver Granville candidate's been accused of. These were bad. I'm glad these candidates stepped down. This is not good. And you don't like to see it in federal politics. Thankfully, the party didn't have to ask them to resign, but, or at least publicly.
There probably was a request not publicly made to them, because the one that had the Israel is secretly hoarding all the vaccines conspiracy post there was a good, what, 2-3 day period between when the story broke and when they actually resigned.
I miss the first stories. I'm actually surprised we haven't had more candidate resignations this round or candidate social media scandals. Like, the biggest story prior to this was the Liberal MP who was accused of being a sexual predator and serial abuser of his staff, who Justin Trudeau was bizarrely standing behind for a significant amount of time before he finally resigned.
And yeah, I don't know if it just means people have gotten better about purging their social media before they announce or start to take the step.
Or if they're vetted better.
That too.
Did the Conservatives lose a candidate besides the one who withdrew just before the nomination?
Yeah, they dumped someone in Toronto earlier this week, I think, over some social media posts from a year or two ago.
That's what I was thinking of, I think. So pretty much all. There was also a weird scandal around one of the Green Party candidates allegedly having signed on to an anti-trans statement, and then that was clarified that no, he didn't know what that was and denied it. At least as far as I know, the Greens haven't had as many candidate scandals, but again, they're not doing so well.
Candidates. And also, I don't know if anyone's... Like, is anyone actually doing oppo on the Greens this cycle?
No.
Yeah, because they have nominated some nutters in the past. What was it, like 2008, 2011? One of those elections. There's a couple 9/11 conspiracy theories.
They have the one candidate, she's running this election, who sponsored petitions asking for an inquiry into 9/11 and into whether Wi-Fi smart meters are giving us all cancer.
That would be the candidate for Saanich Gulf Islands, correct?
Yeah, that one. Meanwhile, their current leader did her long-form interview with, was this Global? CBC, where, among other things, she admitted that through this very campaign, as well as multiple times before, she has considered quitting, which is, like, brutally honest, and thank you for that, Annamie Paul, but not a moving sign of inspiration for your campaign when you're just, like, frankly telling the media, yeah, I've thought about quitting this job multiple times, even during the campaign.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing you generally should keep to yourself during the campaign. Or close friends and confidants, but maybe not a great thing to tell the national media a few days before Election Day. On the other hand, like, it's very believable, almost certainly true, and there's a very good chance she will not be leader this time next year.
She has also said that she will not campaign in Fredericton and is trying to make sure she doesn't go to ridings where she would, quote, not be helpful.
It's a bad sign when the leader going to a riding is seen as not helpful or harmful.
I'm trying to think of past leaders. They're usually the unpopular ones.
Yeah. Like, parties who've been in government for a while on the verge of defeat, and local candidates are trying to save the furniture and distance themselves from the unpopular premier or prime minister. That's probably about the closest I can think of, and not really the same situation here.
So yeah, somewhat good week for the Liberals, mediocre to bad week for the Conservatives, just a week for the NDP, maybe good, maybe bad. Oh, it was this week that Jagmeet Singh got a series of headlines after the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said you can't go after the rich with unlimited zeal, and Singh retweeted it with just "watch me," and then they've made it a meme for most of the week.
I only saw the first post, which at least good. As far as campaign Twitter grunts go, it's on the upper end, but trying to get a week out of it feels a little desperate.
Yeah, I don't think it was quite a week, but I did see a day or two ago they tried to, like, pitch or slog some t-shirts to their supporter list with the, like, Jagmeet Singh with laser eyes being, like, unlimited zeal. That feels a bit much. I would be embarrassed wearing that. And I like the idea. I like the idea of taxing the rich, and I like Jagmeet Singh. I'm not going to wear that shirt, though. But good trying. And yeah, sadly, I think the PPC have had a, not a good week, but their campaign is
they've probably had the best, badly. They've probably had the best week they've had since the party got founded after Bernier quit the Conservatives, what, like 3-4 years ago now?
Forever and a day.
Yeah, like they're actually getting stories about momentum for the first time ever.
John Ibbotson said they need a friggin' seat in Parliament because people will vote for them and people are afraid of non-European immigrants. Fuck.
Yeah, they're doing well. Like, clearly them and Trudeau have a somewhat symbiotic relationship going on at the moment where they're feeding off each other in not great ways.
Oh, this is a depressing topic. Let's switch to what we think will happen.
That isn't a depressing topic?
It's a different one. So I'm putting it out there as my bold prediction that the Liberals will just eke out a majority. And I'm talking like 171 seats. I did the math for mine. So I think 169 seats, 168 is what you need for a majority right now. 338 seats, one person's the speaker. I come to this number because I'm trying to watch the trends in the polls. I think they're doing strongly in Ontario. They're doing strongly in Quebec. They're doing strongly in Atlantic Canada. It's setting up 2015 did, except they don't have anything west of Thunder Bay, really. Like, they have a bit of support in each of the provinces, but they could be looking, depending on which polls you believe, at below 25% in all four western provinces, which means just a handful of seats here and there. Like, maybe they manage to concentrate their vote in the cities and pick up a seat in Calgary or two, a handful of seats here in BC and a couple others across the prairies. But that really closes off their path to a large majority. But the weaknesses of the Conservatives in Eastern Canada open up more seats in Ontario and Quebec. So 171 is where I peg them, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was slightly lower or above. Going down my list, then, the Conservatives I pegged around 106, mostly by process of elimination, by figuring out what I thought everyone else would get. I put the NDP at 40 because I want to be bullish, the Bloc at 20, and the Greens down to just 1.
Okay, I think the Greens at 1 would definitely be the case. As for the others, I am really not sure. The thing I have a hard time getting a sense of is what the turnout is going to be for each party. Yeah, I can flip open a poll and take, or series of polls and take a look, but I don't know. It feels like one of those elections where nobody is that interested in voting.
The PPC people who are
really creepily excited. But the advanced turnout numbers are up, but the mailing ballot request numbers were lower than Elections Canada was thinking. And like maybe just the people who already knew who they were going to vote for anyway voted. But a lot of other people are just so meh on the whole thing that they may or may not turn out on election day. But yeah, I honestly have no sense of how this is going to turn out.
Well, and I was going to say, I think lower turnout would hurt the Liberals, but I don't even know if that's true. I don't actually know who would benefit from a increased turnout at this point.
Yeah, I mean, typically, the Conservatives are assumed to have the most reliable base. Whether or not that's the case this election's also a little uncertain, but I think it will probably hold. I don't know, low turnout will probably help the Conservatives, might even nudge them into minority territory. That is, if the polls hold constant for the next couple of days and they don't get a little bit of a rebound.
So are you going for most likely Liberal minority, like most of the aggregators say?
That's the safe bet, but you know what? You made a bold prediction, so I'm going to make a bold one of conservative plurality.
I'll dig into one of my numbers. I want to look at BC specifically. I think it's very interesting, and it's also what our podcast is mostly about. I could see the Liberals having a really bad night. I don't think they're having 2011 bad night, where they're down to 2, but I could see them down to 5 and the Greens at 1. Based on the aggregators, I can see the Conservatives going to 19 and the NDP 17. This basically means my prediction is the NDP caucus will be 50% from British Columbia. I think that might actually be true right now. the party will continue to be a pretty Western-dominated or British Columbia-dominated party with a scattering of MPs from elsewhere. And the Conservatives will be a very Western party again.
I think it is likely they may be able to pick up one or two seats in the Maritimes, depending on how the regionals break down. They were doing okay there earlier in the election, and they may be able to squeeze one or two out, but we'll have to see.
The other province I want to bring up for election night to watch is Saskatchewan, mainly because I had forgotten Saskatchewan existed throughout this entire campaign until earlier today when I was looking at the regionals of one poll where it pointed out the Sask-Toba, Saskatchewan-Manitoba combined regionals for the PPC were 16%, which is wild. There was a plus or minus 10% error bar on there, but even if you go to the lower end at 6%, it was still higher than what they were getting anywhere else. And past election behaviors would suggest that the PPC are probably more popular in Saskatchewan than Manitoba. So if they're getting 6 to 15% even of the vote there, that's a pretty sizable chunk that plays spoil on a lot of races that I have no clue how it turns out. I don't think the People's Party will get a seat anywhere because I don't think they have a prominent candidate anywhere. Actually, my People's Party candidate was making the Twitter rounds today because she had a TikTok go viral on Twitter about how she was a former NDPer who turned her back on that party because they were too in league with big business. It was wild. It was a trip. I don't know if you watched it, but I was like, wow, she's got signs on two different lawns that I have to pass every day.
Yeah, here in Vancouver East, I've seen the PPC out Burma shaving twice in as many days. There is a 0% chance they would help. Hell, there's a 0% chance anyone but Jenny Kwan wins here, but still, it's...
Bold prediction.
I would love it if this riding became competitive, but it probably won't be.
Their best chance is Maxime Bernier and Beauce, but...
Is it, though? I should see them doing well in, one of the, rural prairie seats. Maybe even getting a second place finish there.
Oh, yeah. You can get a second place finish in rural Alberta having 15% of the vote just because the Conservatives get 70 and then everyone else shares the scraps, so that doesn't say a lot. But yeah, I unfortunately think because they're running more candidates and polling significantly better, it's a safe bet to say the People's Party is going to get more votes than the Greens this go round. I don't believe the People's Party have endorsed electoral reform yet, though they're still on about supply management on their platform. I don't think they've talked about it this year yet, though.
I have not been paying attention to most of their communications, but yeah, no, that's definitely one of those the worst person memes there.
Very fitting. But yeah, so Saskatchewan could see a lot of weird splits. The province is entirely conservative right now, but you could see a few NDP pickups. You could see the Liberals maybe return Ralph Goodale's old seat, but that may have just been a personality cult that kept him in office. Weird things might happen in Saskatchewan. We'll have to see. Let's talk about post-election night. What happens to these party leaders? Who keeps their job? Who goes? Let's start with the easy ones. Let's start with the Greens.
Paul was pretty much on her way out anyway, hanging on just barely. So the fact that she is almost certainly going to lose the riding she's running in because she chose a terrible riding to run in, and they'll probably be knocked down another seat too, because I doubt Paul Manley's going to win in Nanaimo. So, yeah, I think the writing's on the wall for her. And like I said, she'll be gone by this time next year.
I think she'll be gone by this time next week. I don't think she wants the job anymore, and I don't blame her. I don't know. I'm impressed that she stuck around and done her best in some ways, but it's just... not like from everything we've seen from how the party has treated her, I don't know why she'd want to stay on, even if she did win her seat. Maybe she would just want to be an MP then. But yeah, I think election night is going to be her. All right, I got you to this point. I'm out. I'm tearing up my party membership. I'm gone.
Yeah, it could be. Or she could stick around for a few weeks and just burn the party to the ground. Really air the dirty laundry. There's a non-zero chance that happens because doing politics differently and everything. And there's clearly no loss between her and the party executive. in the very likely event she's gone, does Elizabeth May return as the permanent leader?
Oh, I think she gets interim leader. I don't think she wants the job again. I get the sense she does just want to be an MP. I don't know why she wants that job still, other than it's all she knows at this point.
Yeah, I got some confusing signals from her during the what the hell's happening with Anna McPaul's leadership stuff, where it seemed like she was angling to take on more of a leadership role again. But those which would just be Elizabeth May doing the weird Elizabeth May stuff. Who really knows?
I think she doesn't want to be leader, but she wants a leader who does everything she would do exactly the same, if that makes sense. It's going to be real hard to be the next leader of the Green Party if the only MP is Elizabeth May still, I'm just saying. The Bloc is an interesting case. I think if they drop as hard as I would suggest from, you know, the 30s down to 20 or even into the 20s, Yves-Francois Blanchet has been pretty boisterous. He was probably the person most looking forward to this election besides Justin Trudeau. And if it doesn't pan out for him, I think the knives are out in that party. I think he's held it together, but we forget how recently they had a really turbulent, I don't know, decade or more. Yeah.
Like, so 2019 was a bit of a revival for them. There was serious questions in 2011 if the Bloc was even going to be a party going forward.
There was one parliament in there where the party split in half and four members or something like that sat as strengthen democracy, the party or something.
Oh, yeah. I think that was
weird stuff happened that we just up to 2019. Ignored in English Canada.
But yeah, they managed to do a bit of a resurgence in 2019, but from what I gather, Blanchet's ran a pretty bad campaign, and if it wasn't for the English Canada's leader debate throwing him a bit of a bone on that one with that question we talked about earlier, yeah, he would have been on track for maybe even a single-digit number of seats and definitely on his way out as leader, but it's hard to say. On the other hand, is there a successor waiting in the wings?
I don't know.
When they were having that, during that period of turmoil, there was an active question on whether or not they would even be, or whether or not they even had anyone willing to run for leader. It's a party that's been in a weird place over the last decade.
Yeah, that's the extent of our Quebec politics knowledge. Aaron O'Toole, I think, is the next question. It obviously fully depends on performance. So let's start in this kind of scenario. If he ends up basically where he inherited the party from, he holds on, grows the vote maybe a little, maybe doesn't lose any seats, doesn't really gain any, Trudeau's held to a minority, does he have the mandate to stay? Because Scheer didn't.
If he can post seat gains, potentially. But the knives will definitely be out. It's going to be really a question of how he handles the aftermath, I think. If they can win a plurality, then yeah, he can stay. If it becomes a very tight couple-seat minority, but the Liberals are only a few seats above the Conservatives, tight minority, I think he can make the case that it's going to be unstable and they need a continuity of leadership in a likely election within 6 months type scenario. But yeah, if they lose seats or even fail to make any gains, I have a hard time seeing how the knives don't come out right away. And there would be a lot of pressure on him to step down because he did take the party places that the base is not happy with. And that is absolutely the right thing to do to be electorally viable. But the downside of that is the base and the caucus are the ones who actually get to decide whether you keep your job. So if you can't at least offer them victory in exchange for that, it's going to be tough for him.
It's the Tom Mulcair dilemma. Only if O'Toole behaves like Mulcair after, which is to just shrink into the shadows and await a leadership convention, yeah, the knife will be in his back pretty quickly. Don't see that being O'Toole. I think he's got
a bit more fight in him, and he can draw the analogy to 2004, and basically, yeah, this was the 2004 election. Give it 18 months, we'll be back at the polls, and just like Harper did after an election loss, he turned it around and formed government.
The big challenge for him is going to be not even necessarily what number of seats he has, but what number of votes the People's Party get if he doesn't become prime minister. Because if Maxime Bernier can point to having 5% of the vote and that being enough in enough ridings where if you'd combine them, the Conservatives would have won, it's not a correct argument, but it's an argument that would probably win, that the Conservatives need to move far right to become viable in this country.
I mean, that's obviously not the case, because otherwise Andrew Scheer's campaign to the base strategy would have been more successful. But yeah, no, it's definitely going to be the case that you hear the partisans and the ideologues saying, well, the problem why we didn't win is we weren't true enough to our values and whatnot. And
really only the NDP base can make that argument, because we've never won federal power. So it's just from a place of smug self-satisfaction.
Yeah, but yeah, that's the thing about partisans. It's always an element of faith to it on that.
So the last leader, of course, I guess Maxime Bernier keeps his job if he wants or not. It's his movement. I've talked about the People's Party way too much this week. Justin Trudeau obviously stays on as leader if he's prime minister, as in if he has a plurality or a majority. Here's the interesting one. If he doesn't get the plurality, does he try to keep governing as he has
the right
to? It's
really going to depend on the seat count. If it's the case where the CPC has two more seats than the Liberals do, I think he'll try to make a deal with the NDP on that case to keep governing. If it's a case where there's a 20-seat difference, I think he'll probably end up stepping down as prime minister.
And then I guess the other question is just, even if he holds on for another minority, how long does he want to be prime minister for? We don't generally have people lead parties for that long anymore. He's already been prime minister for 7 years.
This is way too wild speculation now. If he holds a minority but doesn't gain any seats, or even just hovers around where he is, or especially if he loses a couple seats, there will definitely be questions, I think, within liberal circles on whether or not the Trudeau is a spent element and they need someone new. So even if he ekes out a narrow win, his own position may not be super secure.
It's weird how the knives haven't been obvious in the Liberal Party. The only knife that really went around was the one Trudeau left in Bill Morneau's back.
Yeah, this is a weirdly...
And he accepted it.
Yeah, this is a weirdly congenial Liberal Party. But they have spent decades constantly fighting each other. Wasn't there a move in one of Turner's elections to replace him mid-election or something? The Trich and Martin fights were hardly the inception to Liberal Party history.
Maybe they're just better at keeping it quiet now. And, the day after election, Chrystia Freeland's going to take the stand and be like, guess who's prime minister now?
Yeah, maybe it's more hidden this version of the Liberals definitely feels a little more cult of personality than it did during the Martin years, or even the end of the Christian years. I can't really say before that, because I don't really remember anything earlier than that politically, but this does feel like a much more kind of leader-centric version of the Liberals, which may not always be to their benefit. I mentioned it yet, but at the start of the election, I was pretty ambivalent about Trudeau. I didn't dislike him, but I didn't really like him either. And this election has just burned through my reserves of patience with Trudeau. And at this point, I would be pretty happy if I didn't have to see him again. And I can't imagine I'm the only Canadian who feels that way.
Election day is 4 days away, probably three or less by the time you're listening to it. Make sure you vote on Monday, September 20th. If you've not done so already, please don't go to the polling stations with COVID. The election workers don't deserve that. We
also
don't have anything planned. Go ahead. Yeah.
Also, if you requested a mail ballot, you cannot change your mind and vote in person. So make sure you get that in the mail.
Do you have to get it into the mail by September 20th? Or should it have already been in the mail?
I think it's a postmark by, let's just quickly Google that. You must return it before the deadline. Okay, yeah, so it needs to be in by September 20th, so get that in the mail right away.
Or drop it off at an elections office, because I don't know if I'd trust Canada Post to get it there in 24 hours. Anyway, we don't have anything planned for election night. We're not planning to do an emergency pod.
Yeah, no, I'd actually gotten tickets for an event for that night before the Prime Minister was rude enough to schedule an election on the same night, so that's unfortunate.
I'm sure I'll be active in the Slack. I may be watching the results with friends or even just at home in my basement with beer. So get on our Patreon if you want to join that conversation. It's always fun times. Maybe we'll leave it there.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.